Okay, guys, welcome to the show. This is Deborah Gets Red Pilled. I think 205 or 206, not quite sure. It's been a little while, but Deborah, you are back from your vacation from Davos, Switzerland. How are you feeling?
Yes, it was so therapeutic almost.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's good to hear. Was the topic of sewer Jews brought up at the conference?
Not at any of the ones that I went to.
Good. That's good
yeah
to hear.
yeah
got to keep that one hidden. What's been going on with you? Can we refrain from any talk of canine anal glands on this intro?
Oh my God. Yes, we can, and it's not even difficult.
Good.
Things are just kind of status quo as usual around here. We did have the sun come out today, which was a nice break. And just plugging along.
Yeah, it was really nice. It's out here right now. It rained all day.
Uh-huh.
Perpetually for the next few months. But I just took a little snooze and I woke up and the sun was out. But yeah, we've been busy around here. So we were supposed to do this show last week, but we postponed and I butchered. Last Tuesday, I slaughtered our big ram and then skinned him and did all that stuff in the barn, hung him up. And then yesterday, I brought him in the house and did all the butchering. And none of it was totally perfect, but it went pretty well for my first try by myself.
Yeah, that's awesome. I didn't ever think I would find myself saying it's awesome about slaughtering a lamb, but now that I'm introduced and I'm with the program.
Yeah, not a lamb, a big old ram,
Yes.
3 or 4 years old. So we cooked up some chops and some steaks last night, and it was pretty tough. So,
is that because of his age or?
Yeah. Yeah. The taste wasn't bad at all. Like everybody had said, like, oh, it's going to be mutton. It's going to be really strong and gamey. But as I was butchering him, you know, he'd been just out in the barn, not refrigerated or anything for the past 6 days. And then there was no smell when I was butchering him. And, but definitely tough consistency. But I ground a good amount of the meat. So I got 28 pounds of ground lamb. And hopefully that's a little bit more edible. But yeah, it made me excited to do an actual lamb, or one that's closer to, you know, 1 year old and under is lamb.
Uh-huh.
1 to 2 is called a hogget.
Hogget.
Yeah, or two tooth is what they call them. I've been watching all these New Zealander guys talk about it, so that's the only reason I know. And then after 2 years, it's considered mutton.
Okay.
I think I'm going to make some shepherd's pie tonight, see how the ground lamb tastes.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's good.
I was thinking maybe some beef lamb stroganoff.
Yeah, that'd be good. We could, you know, that would, I think we're going to have to like stew or slow cook all this stuff that's not ground to get it to be a little bit more edible, but it's really good. These Katahdin lambs are supposedly much more mild in flavor, so they're popular. But other than that, just staying busy on the farm, reading, doing as much as I can with the weather. And I got a little news. I think today is the last thing that we have scheduled on the calendar. I think I want to take a break. What do you think?
That's fine.
Yeah, I don't know if it's indefinite or you know, just a little bit. I'll see how I feel after I'm done, but I'm really just enjoying being here without the added pressure of having to be somewhere else, having to book guests. I'm just really enjoying being on the farm and at my house, and I've really started falling back in love with jiu-jitsu.
That's so
So,
great. And congratulations. I don't think I've spoken to you since you got your new belt.
thank you so much. Yeah.
You are most welcome.
And so yeah, I think we're just gonna take a little break, and then I'll keep the subscription to Podomatic current. So if something pops up, we can do an episode here or there. But yeah, what do you think? How does that make you feel?
That's fine. I mean, I know that I am an anchor
No.
around. Well, you do all the heavy lifting. All I do is show up, and hopefully I've done a little bit of research so I don't sound too whatever. But
Yeah.
yeah, no, that's perfectly fine with
Yeah.
me.
Yeah, it's
And it's heavy. We've been talking about heavy stuff, and
it is. And this year is just gonna get wild. And it's like it's kind of come full circle to the point of like not me not even wanting to engage in the world outside of what's my little world. I don't know if that's good or bad. I kind of know what's going on in the world, and I don't feel the need to really get that much more involved anymore. I kind of know what I can do, what I can't do, what's possible. And I think a lot of that comes from orthodoxy and just being in this for so long. Consistently and knowing what it does to your brain after a little while. I really like doing the stuff that we've been doing is my favorite stuff though. I don't I I'm going to continue reading and researching and doing stuff like that.
Well,
So.
I have learned or solidified some of my not quite solid beliefs, and it's all interesting stuff, but it's difficult because I don't have the background. I don't listen to the same kind of podcasts that you do,
Yeah.
and so yeah, I get it.
Yeah, I mean, I've been ever since I stopped listening to No Agenda, which is a good podcast. I love it. And they've kept me abreast of what's in the mainstream news for the past few years. And I just couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't listen to half of their hosts be so bad on a couple subjects. And I know you can listen to that show just to know what the mainstream media is talking about, and that's what it's good for. But I've been taking that off, and I feel better, I think. And like I said, it's 2024. We got elections coming up, and it's gonna
Agree.
be 2019, 2020, 2.0. And I think the other guy's gonna get in. Or at least there's going to be major shenanigans going
Oh,
on both
hell yeah.
sides. And so I mean, I'm an hour away from the epicenter of the madness. And it's I think it's Bill Hicks who had the joke of, I probably brought it up before, it's you watch the news and the world's exploding, and then you look out the window, and it's, oh, I look out my window now, and there's a bunch of sheep sitting up on the hill in the sunshine. So I mean, that maybe the end of the show is me becoming blue-pilled again. Who knows? But yeah. And then having to self-censor and not really feeling that I can talk about stuff openly that I want to talk about, that kind of made me feel gross and bad about myself. So I mean, I'm not like regretting having taken down just one episode that I've done in 205 or 206 episodes, but we still got to be careful. And I realize that I'm in this weird bubble where I feel like I can just throw things out there, where most of the world's still not quite there yet. So if something ever happened in my way of life, Emily's and I's way of life suffered because of our stupid hobby show that gets 750 downloads, it'd be a real a real blow that I don't know, be tough to come back from. So, but hopefully this isn't the end, and we can do a weird one-off show every once in a while. I hope everybody just stay subscribed to the show if you are, and if we have a bonus episode pop up or something fun happens that we want to talk about, or a guest contacts us or something like that, maybe we can keep it going, and then maybe I'll take a couple months off like I did last summer and be ready to go again. Who knows?
Time will tell. No
But
need to know right now.
yeah, I just want to read and research, and but I can't thank you enough for spending all this time with us. And you know, our relationship is very, very strong because of this show. And I, you know, we would still love each other very much if it had never started. But I think it's we have a special relationship
I
that
think so
most
too.
mother-in-law and son-in-laws don't have together. So
Well, it also helps that I don't live, within 100 miles of you.
we love having you here as
I
much as
love, I
possible, and
love.
I hope pretty soon you live like 60 miles from here. So you should work on that with your spare time.
I'll check the real estate.
Yeah, but yeah, our guests here and guys, if you want to write in farewell letters or what the show's meant to you, maybe we'll have one more episode where we read them on or something like that. If not, no
That's a
big
nice
deal.
idea. That's a nice idea.
But thank you to everyone who's been with us for a long time, and people that have reached out, and I'm in contact with a few people regularly, and it means a lot to us. And just that we could change a couple people's lives and give them hope. So, you know, maybe this isn't the end, but who knows?
But yeah,
But we're
one
gonna
day at
put
a
out
time.
one more good episode. I'm really excited for this one. So let's pause, let our guest in. We'll be right back.
Honestly, I'm.
Oh, sorry, man.
Oh,
Go
no,
ahead.
you're good. Got it.
Okay, guys, we're back with our guest today, Austin. How's it going, dude?
It's going well, guys. I appreciate you for having me on for sure.
Yeah, we discovered you and your podcast, the Underclass podcast, which is absolutely incredible. If you're a weird autist like me, the way that you do your podcast is as good as it gets for me. Just you have a monotone voice, you're coming with straight facts and video clips and everything like that, and it's a amazing historical just overview of this stuff that's real, that it's not conspiracy, it's real. Well, they are conspiracies because they're
Right.
people colluding together, but it's real stuff that happened, it's provable, and you make it pretty palatable. Like I don't understand if how you could give your Pizzagate episode to someone who thinks it's a, like my mom who would say it's been debunked, and just to listen to it and be like, okay, the only argument is what if the only way you could say it's debunked is if we're saying Pizzagate is something different,
Right.
you know. But
Definitely.
yeah, I love your show, and you know, it's dense, it's good. That InSlaw episode, I probably got to listen to a couple more times to make any sense out of that. That's like reading a Whitney Webb book, but.
That's really what it felt like when I came away from that one. My brain was swimming, honestly.
I can't imagine the amount. I mean, you have so many details and you go so deep in the research and so many names and so many events. I don't know how a person can keep it straight.
Thank you so much. Man, that means a lot to me, honestly. Just in anybody appreciating, you know, honestly, the structure is what I'm most proud of because I really do like the format. But really, I've truly, honestly tried to go with my gut with every single topic that I cover, and my process in trying to decide like which topic will be this week's episode is like, it's an interesting process, I'll be honest. But it typically, it's whatever I am most emotionally kind of wrapped up and disturbed in at the time, you know, mostly.
There's
And
enough
so,
of that out there.
oh my gosh, that's 100% true. But I just think that It's weird because it feels like this completely unstable relationship that's entirely dysfunctional for a week straight, and then I move on to the next one, right? And it's like just a crazy, chaotic experience. Because honestly, I like doing these interviews because it gives me a chance to go back to, one of my previous episodes, and I get a chance to explore it even more. Because I need to have, extended periods of time with these subjects in order to, especially if you want to really have working knowledge of the players in each of these stories. So it's I couldn't be more grateful, honestly. But I will say, I've been, a lot of the subjects that I've tackled are extremely dark, especially some of the more recent ones.
Yeah.
And man, like, just for my own well-being, and I honestly have to, like, I have to mix it up, switch it up a little bit, right? Where, like, I'll go parapolitics the next week, because I just can't even stomach, talking about pedophiles for another, 5 seconds. But it really was all due to the fact that I as recent as 2016, right? I was like a Bernie bro. I was completely uninformed, and I really think a lot of that is due to the fact that, I went to public school, and I was basically bathed in cultural Marxism to a certain extent, like most of us are, whether you know it or not, which tends to be, subconscious mostly, that people aren't
Yeah.
even aware of the ideologies they embrace, and but
What part of the
mostly
country
it,
are you in?
well, now, since 2017, my wife and I moved to, first, just to get out. Since I was a child, right, I had like a dream of because I grew up in Northwest Arkansas on a 35-acre farm.
Cool.
My
That's
mom
is
was a
that technically the Ozarks?
yes, it is.
Awesome.
Yep. It's a beautiful area, honestly. And I really very much value that experience now, but, like, growing up, you're a prisoner of your own you're a prisoner of your own experience, your own environment. So,
Yep.
I wanted to explore and experience more, and experience something radically different, you know what I mean? And then also, I was completely kind of influenced by Hollywood, influenced by celebrity culture, influenced by really music as well, because I grew up, like, really getting into the 60s and 70s, hippie style,
Laurel
Laurel
Canyon.
Canyon, yeah, Laurel Canyon type
Did
situation.
you read the Dave McGowan book?
Oh my God, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon.
Did that
That
broke my heart.
it really did, I know.
All
And
my idols.
I'm like, I have to compartmentalize this, because
Yes.
I still enjoy, like, I love the Doors. I always have loved the Doors, and I love, just I mean, it just makes me so sad when I went through that. But at the same time, it resonated with me, and it made so much sense,
Well,
honestly, right?
at least when they were running these ops on us back in the old days, they would put out a good product with it, you know? Like
That's what I'm
today,
saying.
the best they got is mumble rap, and if we're gonna go
Oh
with
my
music
God.
conspiracies or so.
Exactly. They've lost all respect for us, honestly. If
Yeah.
they ever had any to begin with.
Yeah.
But it's got to be a part of, well, it's hilarious because, like I said, right, my mom was a horse trainer. My dad was a truck driver. And I grew up in, like, a very small town, went to a very small school, and but I was entirely influenced by that culture that I mentioned, and to see how far that took me into the drug culture, right? I mean, I basically developed a substance abuse problem. I had to kind of, like, re-examine my life choices and seek help at a certain point, right? Just because I needed one, I had no other option. I basically was court ordered to AA at a certain point, just
Yeah.
so, I wouldn't have to go to prison on some, drug charge, right? But it's crazy, because when you grow up in that environment as well, where I, like I mentioned, where I grew up in, there's not a whole lot for, as far as our local police to, they're not tied up with a whole lot, right? So, and everyone knows each other, and so they knew my car, they knew my name, they knew my parents, and
My hometown cops knew me by name, so
right, exactly. So it was a unique experience, but honestly, if I didn't have any real consequences, then, I mean, maybe I wouldn't have been encouraged to change my ways, at least as quickly as well. But you have to have some type of moral foundation. I do thank my parents for that because, I knew what I was doing the whole time wasn't was definitely not, the ethical and moral way to approach my life if I want to accomplish much. But I feel like that's a huge reason why I have been able to reflect and have an open mind, because I had to, man, I had to face, the reality, right, of what I had done and where my mind was at and all these terrible habits and patterns that I had, allowed myself to cultivate over time. And so it was just like, is so necessary, and I'm so grateful for that time in my life, honestly. But that's when I found, libertarian philosophy, a lot of different, Murray Rothbard and all the individuals who helped kind of like recontextualize, like what I even, what is the role of government? You know what I mean? And what should the role of government be? And like, and the economics aspect of it all helped me in a lot of ways because I had no frame of reference, and so I thought, like a lot of young people, they get seduced into socialism and seduced into these notions that, some of these economic theories and ideologies are not going to have this overall negative impact on, in a lot of different ways. And you have to be exposed to those different perspectives in order to even have the ability to like at least entertain that as being a possibility, right? And I was forced to change my ways and change my ideology, and just from being objective, and feeling like, well, I guess I was entirely wrong about that,
Yeah,
and
I mean, I'm the same as you. I was, I got sober in 2012. My brain kind of started working again around the 2016 election. I was a big Bernie bro, and I was, donating every week to his campaign, $27 a week, out of my paycheck. I was a
right.
union guy, so I felt all proud about it. He sent me a book that I never read. He once again asked me to donate, blah, 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 over and over. And then do you remember what kind of got me being like, what's going on? Was those super delegates when he was in
Oh
the
my
primaries
God.
with Hillary Clinton? And I was like, well, he's totally getting screwed by the DNC. And then he finally bows out and just kisses the ring and says to
Rolled
endorse
over,
and says
showed his
endorse
belly like
Hillary
a good dog.
Clinton. I do that. I do it because my union told me to. And then and then like same as you. Libertarianism, Dave Smith on Joe Rogan, and
Exactly.
became a ardent supporter of that philosophy. And then COVID comes along, and I kind of realized that that was kind of not real either. That's
I
faking gay
know.
too. So,
I'm thinking it.
but
That's great. No,
but.
that's hilarious because that's exactly the same time that I basically became entirely disillusioned to the political process in general, because I felt, I mean, I had his 2016 campaign sticker on the back of my car in Arkansas, and I just I was so deceived, but at the same time, it was such a beautiful moment because it took the mask off, the veil was removed, and for so many people, especially people, I just feel like there's especially the generation and my sister generation, she's 4 years older than me. I just see like these people, they don't have evil intentions, I feel like, mostly, you know, like as far as like people who are deceived and seduced by a lot of these this propaganda and ideological subversion, basically, you know, if you want to be honest. But so I think that, like, that's what I've tried to really make sure that I consider more than anything else is what are your intentions, right? And I feel like I have some, at least some ability to you know, to discern for myself whether someone means, you know, means well or not. But it really does seem like mostly the people who are most certain put in the least amount of effort and typically have, you know, they have never been exposed to such levels of detail about especially just individual cases that might completely convince you otherwise, you know, of as far as the official narratives are concerned, with a lot of different events that take place, or even just crimes in general that are high profile, you know. I mean, how many times have we seen that as well? But I mean, like members of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, Elizabeth Loftus was placed on like over 300, you know, cases, you know, and always for the defense. And I mean, we're talking the most high profile, you know, cases you could ever imagine, you know, Harvey Weinstein, Ghislaine Maxwell, you know, and all the way back to Timothy McVeigh, Terry Nichols, you know. I mean, she participated in those trials as well. And so, like, and for me, like, when you just have realized that you look into any of the, especially those high impact events like OKC, oh my God. I mean, OKC, I mean, Waco and Ruby Ridge, those three right there, that's what red pilled me more than anything on earth, honestly, about.
Have you done this yet?
I haven't, but I've read portions of it. I haven't read the full thing, but all I've ever
So
heard.
I just held up Aberration in the Heartland of the Real by Wendy Painting.
Wendy Painting, yeah.
You read this book, Austin, and you I've said it, you know, Scott on History Homo said it. It turns you into a paranoid schizophrenic. Like, this book is absolutely insane. It's so nuts. It's so dense. It's 540 pages. For a
Oh
slow
my God.
reader like myself, it took me a couple months to get through it. And
Right.
like I said, I had to read it like twice because I'd read it three quarters of a paragraph and be like,
Right.
okay, I don't know what that name is. I have to go back and find that name again and find
Exactly.
out who that is. And so it took a while. And, you know, she doesn't come to a final conclusion. She lets you do it yourself, and she gives you a thousand different things that could have happened. And, you
Right.
know, that's
That's my
why,
favorite.
you know, talking with Richard Booth and Ken Silva is great. And then, I mean, it must be like so you got red pilled probably, you know, the same time with Bernie stuff as me, and then started, did you start consuming alternative media, podcasts, things like that?
It's kind of interesting because it all really started when I saw Real Time with Bill Maher back, like, before even the 2016, I believe, because I found Jeremy Scahill from he had co-founded The Intercept with Glenn Greenwald, but he had written that book called Blackwater, right? About about that private mercenary outfit ran by Eric Prince. Remember, isn't Betsy DeVos like his isn't that her name? She was in the Trump administration, I think, if I'm
Education.
remembering. Yeah, so
Yeah,
she's like,
education minister.
I think she's like the sister of Eric Prince, who ended up changing Blackwater's name, just rebranding after all the terrible press,
What are they
to
called
like,
now?
it was like Frontier Services or something like that. Yeah, if I remember correctly. But anyway, I just like when I read that book, and I like, and then I read Dirty Wars, right, which is Jeremy's other book. And that was when I was still kind of a little leftist leaning and things of that nature. But that really like helped drive home, you know, the anti-war principle that I kind of abide by now. And that's when I found Scott Horton. And when I found Scott Horton, I mean, he basically, I bought, A Fool's Errand. I remember I was listening to him before he came out with that. And then when he came out with it, I bought it as soon as possible. And I read that book as fast as I could. And my God, brother, like, you just come away from the terror wars. I mean, I'm opposed to all wars, but still, it's just like, what war have we not been lied into? Like, please tell me that, and who has it ever benefited, besides, the elite controllers in our governments, you know what I mean? And but that is
Remember
really
when he
my.
who did he, well, it was the neocon guy that he debated.
Oh, yeah. Oh my God.
Famous one. I don't know why
I know
it's
I
slipping my
watched it
mind.
too.
But yeah, that was eye-opening, and it's
That
a
was
bummer.
shameful.
Like
That guy did terrible.
300 people probably watched that interview, or that debate. But it
Right.
was, eye-opening that, there was no, I mean, Scott Horton pretty much just asked the dude, oh, what was it? It's not John
Bill
Bolton. It's
Kristol. Bill
Bill
Kristol.
Kristol.
Isn't
Yeah.
that? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he pretty much just answered his own questions that nothing that no intervention that we've done. He said like maybe Bosnia was a good
Yeah, he
idea
had no
after the
defense.
fact. Yeah. So.
No, it was insane. That's just incredible to me that, yeah, but what type of ego can allow you to engage in a debate? And I mean, how could you even show your face at that point? You have to be a sociopath of some
Yeah, I
kind,
mean, because nothing in his life changed from that. None of his buddies watched that, or if they did, they think that Scott Horton was a dick about it or something like
Right.
that. But he just goes about and doing his own job, and he'll get some job in some think tank or
Yeah.
some NGO or some presidential
Right.
cabinet in the future, and he'll continue, oppressing
No doubt.
people that look different from us all around the world, for to enrich in him and his people like him, But
Exactly.
what got you into do you have any questions, Deborah?
No, well, are we going to talk about some of your later episodes
We could
at
talk about
have
whatever you want.
Yeah, it's honestly, I'm up for anything. I came like fully prepared with notes for like to lay out the PatCon relationship to Ruby Ridge and like mention Waco a little bit, but I'm ready to go with whatever you guys have questions on as well. So
Yeah,
it's okay.
let's do that. I mean, Ruby Ridge is what I mean, that's the biggest grievance for me. Randy
Me
Weaver
too.
was probably a little bit more racist than me, but probably not much.
Right.
And
Yep.
I feel like I, I did some things like on the opposite end of the spectrum during the COVID lockdowns because I was full of fear. And there's
Right.
I mean, if I'm sure I was in areas where there was feds. And
Right.
I did some dumb stuff that I could get in big trouble for. And I'm not, as far as I know, but
Right.
I could have definitely been goaded into doing something
Right.
equivalent to sawing off a shotgun a quarter inch too
Oh my
short
God.
for what federal
You
law
know, I
states
heard
is
later,
legal.
I heard after the fact, it came out in court that he potentially wasn't even the one who that he sawed it down to the legal limit. Now, I also heard another report. Now, but that came out of court. But I heard another report that said that he had begun to the cut at the legal limit, and then Magasono, I think, is the Kenneth Fadley, who was the undercover BATF agent that convinced him to do this, if I recall. But basically, Randy had begun the cut at the legal limit, and then this guy was like, "No, let's do it just a little bit shorter." And I read that, but then I read another account that said that Randy never cut it below the legal limit, and that someone else filed it down, and they claimed it was actually the FBI who did that.
I mean, what's
So
how would
that's
you
possible.
how would you ever know? How could you just do
Exactly. How
that?
could you
I
can't
mean,
defend
how could you?
yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah,
But
so
I think right before I briefly described like what PatCon like really is, and I love it because Jesse Trinidad, man. I mean, like, that's the silver lining out of OKC, right? Like that they messed with the wrong guy. You know, like they I mean, it was like a gift from God that he was pulled sideways into that terrible scenario. And I know that sounds terrible, but at least if we can take one positive out of the tragic things that happened, including to his own brother Kenneth, I mean, it's that at least we got Jesse, you know, to get involved to such a degree that he was so passionate that he has never dropped this, you know. And like he's a hero, man. I mean, I could only hope that if I had a brother, like that he would love me like Jesse Trinidad loves his brother. You know what I mean? Like that's how it resonated with me. And then beyond that, like I mentioned, I grew up, you know, on a 35-acre farm, out on the farm with my dog, you know, with my gun. Like that's how I grew up. And so like I feel like I'm Sammy. You know what I mean? Like that's how it felt during during this. Like it's just so nuts, but thank God that we have the accounts that we do. Thank God Sarah at least survived and Randy survived, and they could write a book about it as well and at least give us some kind of idea, you know, as to how it really happened. But I
Yeah,
just
it's
think
have you watched that PBS documentary about it? They do a surprisingly honest and good
I
job
haven't
with it.
watched it.
It's good. It's
No, I
on
haven't.
YouTube, and they don't play for the other side at all.
Really?
I know
Okay.
there's a ton of other things to do. I've listened to this guy Devin Stack, who has the Black Pilled channel,
I've
and
actually heard about that.
you should check him out. He's done like 40 hours on PatCon,
Oh, awesome.
and But yeah, there's a really good PBS one, and they have the guy. Have you ever heard of the book, Every Knee Shall Bow?
Yeah.
They have that
Who wrote
guy.
that again?
Oh, I got it over here somewhere. I haven't read it yet. I forget the guy's name, but he's super based, and he's on
I
that.
think I cited that book recently. I'll be honest.
Yeah, he's maybe I'll read. I'm finishing a book today. Maybe I'll start that one. But I've talked about it before. My wife and I went on a road trip from Oregon into Idaho and Montana during the summer of 2021, and it was amazing just because like Oregon was, we lived close to Portland and it was the epicenter of lockdowns, and then we get out to Idaho and everybody's just like nice and friendly and not doing any of that
Oh my
stuff,
God.
and I cried like multiple times.
Right.
But for real, like we went to a farmer's market in Bonner's Ferry, Idaho, and I was like met a bunch of Mennonite people who were like so nice to me and
Wow.
like just
That's
like
so cool.
not what I was used to, and I like broke down and cried. But
I don't blame
we
you.
went from there and drove up to Ruby Ridge,
Oh, wow. That would be
and
so cool.
it's a very it was a
Gotta
weird
be
it's
beautiful
a it's
area
a
though.
yeah it's a beautiful area.
Yeah.
It was like an overcast 95 degree day, and it was just there's a heavy feeling there. There's nothing there, man. There's no mention, no nothing. It's
What?
it's got like a
Not
f it's
a
got a f
memorial or anything?
nope it's got a Forest Service like little like picnic area with like a fire pit
Wow.
and like one of those boards with the plastic over it that show the maps. You can go like hiking up there, but I
Wow.
guarantee as soon as they could, they tore down that house
Of
and just made
course.
it Forest Service land again. So,
Right.
but we left some flowers there and walked
That's
around a
awesome.
little bit, and yeah, but it was I'm happy I got to go there, but definitely a heavy, eerie feeling.
No kidding, man. I would just be trying to retrace the wide junction in the trails and like figuring out like how it actually happened. That would be weird though. I
Yeah,
can't even
like we
imagine.
were down as far as like where you could drive in, and I think the house was like a mile up on the ridge, so we weren't anywhere close to it just because there was no trails or roads or anything up to it. But
Yeah, man.
I think they deleted that part of history as soon as they could to make
I
not,
remember.
so he wouldn't become a martyr. Well,
Right.
I mean, he didn't even die.
Right,
But
right.
so it
But I mean,
couldn't be a yeah.
he did become a face of the movement, though. You know, so
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, do what you want. But we will never forget, right? Like, at least there will be us, you know. But that it sucks though. But it makes sense that that's their MO. I mean, you know, every time what happened to the Murrow Building, you know what I mean? It's just like we never get a chance, you know, to actually look at the hard evidence, right? And there's a reason for that, in my opinion. But I think I even remember in the court trial, didn't they pick up his house and bring it down on in during the trial? I know they did that with Kaczynski, which happened in 95, but I'm almost positive that they like moved his home in order to like actually show it in during the trial, and they had it in a warehouse.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Bizarre.
It was really weird. Yeah. But anyway.
What was in the house that was of interest to anybody?
It was basically, I think they were just trying to show the jurors and anyone who was involved in you know, any type of decision making that was happening in the trial. They wanted to give them a chance to see the evidence in the house that was apparently untouched after Randy had been taken into custody once the negotiation process had completed. So I can't remember exactly what the primary reason was, you know, for them moving it like that, but it seems like during the 90s that was like a part of their trial process, if possible. And they would take these remote cabins and like actually bring them down and put them into evidentiary web warehouses, and then have like, yeah, actual officials in the trial like go through the physical evidence. But anyway, who knows what happened to that? That's, you know, but like everything else, if it matters, it tends to disappear while in their custody, right? But
Yeah, because he went on trial after he came down for the murder of the federal of the were they marshals or ATF guys?
it was U.S. I believe it was federal marshals. It was at that came down that day when the firefight started. But if I remember, it's pretty much like, you know, I'm trying to remember what exactly. What was the question you asked right before you asked if it was federal marshals? I can't remember where I was going with that.
I don't think, but he so it was federal marshals. So he had oh he had to go on trial for the murder of
Oh yeah.
those agents,
So
and he
I
was
know
he's acquitted.
Kevin Harris, the friend, he was the one who actually fired the shot that killed the federal marshal. And so he, I think, inevitably did a little time, if I remember correct, but it ended up getting, I think, now I know that they were basically acquitted for the murders, but Randy had to end up doing time for
Or the
the
original
actual,
shotgun
yeah.
offense.
Well, it wasn't for the shot. Well, it was, but
It was
it
for
was
missing his
for
court date,
missing his court date. Yeah.
where they and
Failure to
they had
appear.
mailed his his whatever. This is
Summons
when
or
see, yeah, summons is when
right.
you need to appear, and gave him what did
Exactly.
they either mail it too late or they gave him the wrong date? I forget which
They
one it
gave him the
was.
wrong
Oh,
date. Yeah.
jeez. And then that's what they were said that they were going to come get him for, and he was like, no, like you guys
Right.
screwed
And they
up. I'm not
saw it.
coming down.
But instead of waiting for the actual date that they had given him, right, to see if he would actually appear for the 20th, I think was like March 20th or something. And they gave him like February 20th, right? And so he, or no, I mean, it's the opposite of that. They gave him March 20th, and it was actually for February 20th, right? And so instead of waiting that month, you know, to actually see, 7 days or 6 days before March 20th to see if he would actually show and appear, they filed for an indictment, right? And you know, which they got, and is how the basically the warrant was you know, served. But that's when they launched the operation, you know.
And had they already approached him to be an informant? They had a it seemed like retaliatory because he
Oh yeah.
denied the offer to become a paid informant of the or the FBI,
he
right?
flat out denied it. Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty sure he told him to fuck off like twice at least.
Yeah.
You know, like that was his quote. You
yeah.
know.
Yeah, and but, that place, you know, the Aryan nations up there, that I grew up in the Pacific Northwest and I'm 44 years old. So I was a, you know, young teenager when all this was going on, and I can remember vividly all this stuff happening in around me.
And I heard go ahead, I'm sorry.
I don't know where I was going, but you go ahead, sorry.
No, you're good. I just saw that, like, at that, now that you mentioned that, I was wondering if you remember seeing much of the media coverage at the time, because allegedly there were like the media were showing shots of these like protesters, not the ones that came with the signs that said the Fed shot first and your houses will be next, not those people, but they were covering these alleged apparent Aryan nations, white supremacists who were like in Klan hoods and had swastikas and were out there.
There was a bunch of like young skinhead kids out there and stuff like that too.
Okay. I think it could be legit.
Yeah. That was real. Those guys were there.
So,
and I think at some
the
point,
only
like,
reason
they tried
sorry,
to smuggle
I'm
up like a these young skinhead guys tried to smuggle up a thing full of guns to them.
Oh my God. Now see, you know what that makes me think of, right? It makes me think that, first of all, Randy's claims he didn't associate with any of these people. And that they either just took it upon themselves because they were that ideologically affiliated with that movement and wanted to go and support him, which is how the media covered it, which was like, you know, it's natural. These are his people. He's an actual white supremacist neo-Nazi. So, you know, it helped. It provided an addition, you know, it provided that narrative that they were attempting to push, was that these people are hate mongers, racists, and clearly they're white supremacists and basically Klansmen, neo-Nazis. And so they were showing a lot of those people more than any of the neighbors or any of the people who meant well, who didn't affiliate with that, you know, ideology.
Yeah.
And then Randy himself claimed, and you know, all the evidence that I could find claimed that the one meeting that he had gone to at that Aryan Nations Congress or whatever, he was invited to by Frank Cumnick, who the ATF was initially trying to flip as an informant. And so, but they both only went to this meeting one time. And allegedly when they interviewed Randy, he claimed that neither him or Cumnick were members of the Aryan Nations, and that Cumnick was actually affiliated with this covenant sword and arm of the God of,
oh, yeah,
of
CSM.
The Lord. Yeah. And so,
and they were out of like somewhere around where you're from.
Right. And so he was pissed that they were trying to conflate this as if every single person who went there shared the exact same ideology, you know, because it was like an Elohim City type situation where, like, it seemed like everyone there was basically the feds were infiltrating that meeting.
That's the point that I remember that I couldn't just remember a minute ago. That's the point I was trying to make, is that it was like damn near 50% in that place was either a federal informant or an undercover agent.
Yeah, and it was both FBI and ATF that were there infiltrating that meeting with informants. And later on,
it's
so
everybody.
Crazy.
If you read a great book that I've read is, because it's pre Ruby Ridge. It was written in 1989. It's about Bob Matthews and the order, the Silent Brotherhood. It's called The Silent Brotherhood, and it's it's not a conspiratorial book at all. It's just the story of this guy Bob Matthews, who started the order, which is what that really terrible Tom Berenger movie is based on. He was robbing banks and stuff like that, and he was affiliated with the Aryan Nations in the Pacific Northwest. So
okay,
I understood it that the Weavers had been to the Aryan Nations a bunch of times. Maybe he just went to like an official meeting once,
Yeah,
but
it was like,
they would go to like the picnics and things like that, so the
right.
kids would have kids to play with because they were up on the hill being
Exactly.
homeschooled and stuff like that. And I mean,
Exactly.
as much as it's like, you know, that was the culture for white people in
Right.
Northern Idaho at the time. I mean, that's what
And that's the other
that's
thing.
what you had.
It goes back to like what I mentioned about what are your intentions? You know what I mean? And like if I can tell, like everything I can tell about the Weavers, they didn't seem to be actively, you know, actively like they certainly didn't seem violent from anything that I could, you know, could tell from any evidence that I could find. You know, so as far as that's concerned, it's like everyone.
I think he definitely noticed stuff, if you know what I mean.
Right. No, I mean, I'm certain
But
that.
I mean, I'm sure he had leanings that way.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not
But
trying to completely.
But I mean that,
Yeah.
you know, that's neither here nor there. He wanted to be left alone. He didn't want to go out
Exactly.
and do stuff
That's my
about it.
main point, right? Like, yeah, if as long as you're not actively violating the non-aggression principle, you're not stealing people's property, which are basically my core principles, then, you know, in my opinion, it's like, you know what? If you're not acting on like it most of the time, right? If your main priority is to be left alone above all else, I mean, I've never had a problem with people like that. Like, you know what I mean? And I know that clearly I'm a white person and like, you know, people can make that argument. But at the same time, it's like I've just met so many people who also they'll talk that game because they're in that cultural environment. But then the first time they come into contact with, you know, this supposed group that, you know, that they allegedly want to subjugate or whatever the idea is, they don't tend to behave that way. I mean, it seems to be more of an individualistic approach and perspective of you do right by me and we'll be okay. You know, as long as you don't intervene in my life, you know, I won't in yours. Right. And I think their number one thing was that, yeah, they were white separatists, you know. So I don't know how much they were actually white supremacists. I know that they conflated that a lot, and that's what they try to label them as, you know, and that's possible. But as far as I could tell, they just wanted to have the option to live amongst their own race, their own ethnicity, to associate with their own chosen groups that they wanted to associate with. And as far as I could tell, they believed that the main reason, and I heard Randy say this, that the main reason that they left Iowa was because they couldn't homeschool their son Samuel, you know, who and their children in general, and so they had to go to Idaho for that reason, as well as he says kids in the city, they grow up with skateboards and basketballs or something, and he said, in the country, you know, you grow up with a dog and a gun, right? And he's like, and it's not for hunting. He says it's for defending yourself against a government that could potentially become tyrannical. That's what Randy said. I was just like, man, this guy's speaking my language. No, you know what I mean? So I don't know, but he didn't feel to me like he was this person filled with hate that would treat, you know, everyone he came into contact with it, you know, but who knows? I don't know the guy. You know, it's just how it came off to me from the videos I had seen of him speaking and the things that he had tried to explain, you know, to the media himself. You know, and you're always trying to put your best face in, you know, forward when you're in those moments. But still, he somewhat convinced me that he didn't have like these evil intentions at the very least. He just wanted to associate with his own group and be left alone, right?
Yeah, I
And he
mean,
had no respect for
he
government
recently
property.
died, you know, while I've been doing this show, and he lived out his life doing just making appearances pretty much at gun shows and like
Exactly.
signing autographs, and like you didn't hear about him getting in big trouble or doing
That's what I
anything or
mean.
like running a brothel like Bob Lazar or
Oh, God.
something like that, you know?
For
Like
real. Dude, that Disclosure Project to me is a, I don't know. It seems like a you know, some type of government operation, in my opinion.
Oh, no doubt. It's the last vestiges of them getting boomers to comply. Like,
yeah, I agree.
That's the only people that are falling for it. Them and Midnight Mike from OBDM. But like,
that's great. Oh, but, I just found, by the way, I found that Jesse Trinadu, right? He had so I mentioned him before, but I didn't realize that he had like filed a part of his FOIA request was that he had gotten this document, and he didn't. It was basically about this program called the Sensitive. It was the FBI's Sensitive Informant Program. And it was the first that I had heard of this. I didn't actually hear that there were documents that were available for this and as a part of Jesse's FOIAs. But he filed a motion and they were forced to put out this document. And it basically admits that it says this matter is currently set for an initial pretrial conference on March 21st, 2013. The purpose of which is to, among other things, settle discovery issues. That is also the purpose of this motion, which is to determine whether plaintiff, which was Jesse Trinadu, is entitled to limited discovery into defendant, Federal Bureau of Investigation's sensitive informant program, which is used by the Bureau to recruit and or place informants on the staffs of members of the United States Congress and perhaps even federal judges, which that was apparently proven through his FOIA request. And then
that there's federal judges that are informants.
No, he said within. He said this is what it says. It says, which is used by the Bureau to recruit and or place informants on the staffs of members of the U.S. Congress and perhaps even federal judges in the national media, which Jesse said it was like the managers at these major media organizations were legitimately a part of this sensitive informant program. I was just like, of course, you know, but at the same time. And then it says, within other federal agencies, as well as the White House, on defense teams in high profile federal and or state criminal prosecutions, which we know. And apparently they had admitted to having one of these sensitive informants from this sensitive informant program as a part of McVeigh's defense team, which like, yeah, which it's just perfect. You know, like how many times can we get more, you know, reinforcing details and, you know, as to how that court case got entirely just, you know, it was a complete miscarriage of justice. I mean, what a joke, you know. And the same with Terry. I mean, the fact that Jesse was barred from even going to see him, and after he had gotten to go see him one time, and he said, Jesse, just get me in front of a grand jury, I'll blow this whole thing wide open. Yeah. And Jesse could never go back. And he had an FBI minder in the room with him when he said that, which I just thought is crazy. But
the crazy part about the weird thing about the trial is that it was expedited by the fact that McVeigh didn't want barely any defense at all. Like, and that's what Aberration gets into big time, is like he wanted the death sentence. He didn't want any.
Right.
He had, and there was a whole bunch of cases where like, the prosecution withheld stuff. Judges found out, said they needed to extend the stay of McVeigh's life. You know, they needed to extend his death sentence to properly investigate the stuff that wasn't turned over to the defense. And, you know, he didn't want any of it. He wanted to, you know, and that's where it gets weird is,
some sort of mind control on him?
Oh my God, thank God you said it, Deborah.
That he thought,
all I'm thinking,
I don't think they didn't kill him, but I think he thought that they were gonna send him some sort of double, make it look like he died, and then he was gonna go do black ops.
I 100% agree.
There's no chance that they would keep that guy alive. It's not like
Exactly.
there's some other extremely damaged Gulf War vet that they could just use for the next round, you know?
That's just how I felt too, because the fact alone that we have the mind bender himself, Mr. Dr. Lewis Jolyon West,
Yeah.
showing up to do the psychological evaluation for Mr. Tim McVeigh. And then you have, like I said, Elizabeth Loftus from the False Memory Syndrome Foundation inserting herself in both cases. I mean, to me, I mean, and especially after hearing, I forget the name of the guy that was on, that was incarcerated with McVeigh, that
Hammer,
came out,
John Hammer, was that his name?
John Paul Hammer or something like
Yeah.
that. It was something like that. And yeah, he basically said that,
Yeah,
that
that's.
McVeigh himself was convinced,
Do you know
that.
about that guy, Deborah?
No,
So
I
there's this
don't.
guy, John Paul Hammer, who was a death row inmate in the cell. I don't know, like what. I thought he was in like the Supermax in Terre
Yeah.
Haute, Indiana. It doesn't seem like it's like an old West type cell where you could talk to the guy next to you, but somehow they were communicating. And this guy, John Paul Hammer, I don't, is he dead? Did he get put to
I'm not
death?
sure if he's dead or
He
not.
wrote a book that he says that is the whole story that McVeigh told him while they were in prison together. I sent a message to Richard Booth and asked him if it's worth reading. And he said, yes, there's some definite inaccuracies in it. And I was like, do you think that I could discern those with my basic knowledge of the case? And he said, probably. He said he's that guy's done a bunch with Jesse Trenadue, and then there was some real 4D chess stuff that Jesse Trenadue is doing with that guy's testimony and all this stuff that was over my head that I couldn't follow.
Interesting. Wow, I didn't know about that. That's it. I honestly, I've never read his book, but I did hear the interview he did with Scott back in the day.
Oh,
And he
really?
yeah, and he just straight up said all this. I think I actually no, I think I only I might have just used the transcript for that, honestly, at the end of my OKC episode of what he actually said to Scott, of what Tim said to him. But man, I for sure I had the audio though, and because I saved that right away. I was like, man, that is insane, right? Just the fact that McVeigh himself would believe so, just he really believed that. Well, and I do believe he was sheep dipped, but it makes sense that narrative would apply. You know what I'm saying? And that he would buy that. But there's no way that, I mean, it does seem like there's some MK Ultra type of application as far as to convince him to that extent that he had no concern and that they would never allow him to die, right? I mean, that was pretty extraordinary alone, I thought. Especially when you had that weird mishap with the hearse and like taking his body from the execution. It's like a total, like, I forget, but they had like tricked the media, and they because there was like a media helicopter and everything, reporters were outside if I remember, and they had like tricked them by making them think it was a different car that never actually had McVeigh's body in it. And I
Yeah.
forget the details of that,
And I
but
can't remember if it was like the Weekly World News or National Enquirer, the week before the execution put out a picture of his dead body and said that he was dead.
interesting.
Yeah, I like you I here it
The
is right
week
here.
before?
Yeah. Dead McVeigh on the Mc here, see? It's Weekly World News. And this is
Whoa, I have
before.
never seen that, man.
Yeah, this is
That's
before.
crazy.
So, listen. Let's see. Well, it'll take me too long to find it, but yeah, this was pre the execution.
Right. Wow, that is crazy. So, like, I did want to explain what just I have like two different definitions of PatCon that I think are pretty explosive that I really enjoy using. But right before I described that, I felt like honestly, I wanted to briefly introduce a little bit of this with another like reinforcing example that basically it truly seems to implicate the prevailing mentality of these corrupt federal agencies, right? And it as well as provides us with like a decent enough jumping off point for some of the Ruby Ridge stuff as well. But it's like I said, the Ruby Ridge for me, that direct personally, that affected me more than all others. I mean, I will say Waco and OKC are a close second, basically, and just Terrence Yakey's story and Kenny's story are so just extraordinary and sad, but so I resonate with those as well. But this one for me was personal. But so I feel like it's we should at least mention this part because I think this is how these agencies consistently behave, right? Like I've said before, it's just another example of the self-licking ice cream cone that is government, right? Like, and so after Waco, right? I think this is insane because during the congressional inquiry, following the ATF siege of the Branch Davidian complex, Henry Ruth was one of the three independent reviewers from the U.S. Treasury Department. And he testified that the ATF needed good publicity with its appropriations hearings a week away. A successful raid this size would produce major positive headlines to counter the ATF's reputation as a rogue agency whose debacles blackened the reputations of other agencies, and it would scare the public enough about fringe groups to create political pressure on Congress to increase its budget.
It
Right?
was you get you understand what that means, Deborah? It was the make good for Ruby Ridge.
Kind of
That's
backfired.
so nuts.
Yeah. But they were still
Yeah.
they you gotta hand it to them. They were still able to twist the narrative.
Especially when you see people at that time. Like, I mean, I was seeing like it looked like middle-aged white women who were going down there pissed, but they were pissed at the Branch Davidians, man. They really seemed to be on. Now there were others who definitely, were trying to defend them, but at the same
Yeah,
time,
Tim
I just couldn't
McKay
believe.
was there.
Yeah, when I saw those, when I saw the video of him passing out those pamphlets and had selling those bumper stickers and all that, like, man, to me, I was just like, operation confirmed, man. Like that's what it felt like to me. But it could be natural, but there's absolutely no way in my mind. Like I just can't believe that Timothy McVeigh would naturally go to Waco and then commit the bombing on the same anniversary. And I mean, it's like just too perfect of a narrative for them, you know?
And then they
It
also
I
get to
there's no way.
throw in the they always get to throw in the Hitler's birthday
Oh my
thing with it
God.
too, you know?
That's so ridiculous, man. Like,
Yeah.
especially when you have like as much of the evidence as we did from the explosive experts explaining that, that there were clearly demolition charges on, key pillar support pillars in the Murrow Building. I mean, beyond Terrence, when he wasn't supposed to go back down there one night when he's all messed up and he can't even walk very well, and he's basically still trying to recover from being the first on the scene at the bombing and all of that. He gets Tanya, his wife at the time, or ex-wife, and he gets her like in the middle of the night to like take him down to the Murrow Building, to the site. And this was after they had just so this was the exact same time, I guess the next day, it was supposed to go into federal jurisdiction where they were going to take complete control of the site. And so basically he said it was like, we have no other choice. There's no more time. Like, I have to do this now. And so he couldn't recover physically before so he couldn't even drive. Otherwise, he
Does
would have
she
gone down
say
there by himself.
what he was trying to go down there to get?
This is the part because what I found out was that Terrence claimed he saw explosive charges undetonated underneath. There were additional charges that didn't detonate that he saw underneath that Dare K center that yeah. killed those children.
And then there's all the testimony, all the testimony from people that were the first responders there saying they kept getting pulled out. And then the FBI would go in.
Yep.
And in and here, they said, in Aberration, she talks about there's testimony from a guy who was down there working and saw them, people in like an ATF or a FBI windbreaker go up and get the videotape. Yeah. Or take the whole camera off the building or something like that.
They said they call off the rescue effort in order to go and seize the cameras. It's like, man, people could have survived. Like some people could have lived. And instead you guys are prioritizing the camera footage. You know, that makes sense. And by the way, you know, McVeigh only got charged
for 13 of them. It was 13 agents, right?
It was only for the federal agents. That was it. That was all he was charged for. It wasn't like anyone else who actually was, you know, killed in that.
Yeah, all the little black kids that got bombed and stuff like they didn't care about.
I mean,
them.
That's so crazy, right? That was like, to me, that's just spitting on their grave. Like, I mean, are you kidding me? You know, I mean, that's disgusting. But
did you get a chance to listen to Tanya Yeeke on No Way Jose?
I did.
That was incredible, man. She seems like an extremely just strong, impressive human
being. She made
me
cry, man.
Deborah, she recently, Terrence Yeeke, do you remember that? That was the cop who apparently killed himself by like dragging himself through the dirt and like hanging himself and then shooting himself in the top of the head twice. Like within the last month, his wife has been on a podcast and talked about it.
Wow.
It was pretty awesome. Yeah. She moved me with it. I'll tell you that much. It was an emotional experience, but I love Terrence, man. I mean, he's a hero of that entire story, you know? I mean, that's just like the most incredible thing. And I think that he got hold of that. So, you know, that FBI tape existed because the ABC, they put in detail what they saw, you know, on that FBI tape that would have shown.
What did they say? What did ABC News, what did they say they saw?
I think it was NBC, actually. Okay. It was an affiliate of NBC. But
okay,
I remember
like the local OKC affiliate.
Exactly. And they claimed that they had seen the footage before the FBI seized it. Right. Okay. And they could only describe it because clearly they weren't allowed to show anything. And the guy explains how it shows the Ryder truck pull up to the building. It shows McVeigh get out of the truck. And then it shows McVeigh walk away. It shows a secondary person getting out of the Ryder truck, walking in front of it, like into the street to where a semi truck, and this was a key witness, he had to stop his truck, and he clearly saw John Doe too. And he goes, so this John Doe too then turns back around, goes back around to the other side of the passenger side of the Ryder truck. It opens the door, gets back in, not fully, but he's messing with something in the truck. Now, they say that this could have been the detonation device that would have actually allowed the Ryder truck to be set to detonate, basically, you know. And I don't know if that's the case, but that's just like what I've heard people basically claim is that potentially what he was doing when he went back to mess around in the passenger side before closing it and then leaving as well. But he went a separate direction that McVeigh did.
Yeah, so maybe McVeigh, you know, like there's the reports of those two Ryder trucks at the hotel.
Yeah.
And so what I think, I don't know if anybody else has come up with this idea. If it's totally dumb, let me know. But I think they switched them on him. I think he thought that it was some sort of dummy bomb or like a benign thing. And then so maybe the John Doe too,
that's
whoever
possible.
It was, Richard Booth said he thinks it's that Middle Eastern guy. I hadn't heard that until he told me that. But maybe, you know, John Doe too is the real guy and knew it was up and had to,
Right.
like, Timothy McVeigh's like, oh, we're just gonna drive this down there. There's gonna be a fake bomb in it, and they're gonna discover it and say this, there's what right-wing nationalists that are
Exactly.
terrorizing the country. And then this guy, it's a real bomb.
Well,
This guy
that's
goes in
crazy.
and this guy goes in and sets it off.
That's so crazy that Richard said that because, wasn't the original narrative that it was Middle Eastern terrorists that were responsible for the OKC bombing at first, and that was what the media was running with to begin with, was that it was potentially like Iraqis, that I think it actually was like what they claimed was
Yeah,
that
because
Iraq was potentially responsible.
the original Twin Tower explosions, I think, were in 1993. So,
Yeah, that's what I was actually the World Trade Center bombing, Omar Abdul Rahman. And that was totally a false flag, in my opinion. Man, that's just so crazy. And by the way, we should also remember the signed deposition given by, convicted co-conspirator Terry Nichols, connecting a recurring character in these unnecessary tragedies. And Nichols, he wrote in the deposition that McVeigh was extremely upset and angry. There, in what I believe was an accidental slip of the tongue, McVeigh revealed the identity of a high-ranking FBI official who was apparently directing McVeigh in the bomb plot. The name McVeigh let slip was Larry Potts, lead FBI agent at Ruby Ridge.
Oh, jeez.
McVeigh said he believed Potts, and by the way, he's the one that everyone says is responsible for changing the rules of engagement at Ruby Ridge, right? Which was the now you can and should shoot on sight, right?
Yeah,
And
can and
yeah.
should.
Exactly.
That's what he, yeah.
100%. And so, other than that, McVeigh said he believed Potts was manipulating him and forcing him to go off script, which Terry Nichols says he understood meant to change the target of the bombing, which yeah, that could totally be the case. Who knows how much McVeigh was in on every single aspect of this plot. That's kind of how I think as well, because it seems like it's not like he was the ringleader and the only individual who was clearly involved. And so, other than changing the target of the bombing, Nichols said that was the only time that he ever heard McVeigh refer to Larry Potts. And Larry Potts did not only supervise the Waco massacre and the siege at Ruby Ridge. He has also been implicated in directly supervising the FBI's PatCon operation. And almost immediately after the 95 bombing, he was conveniently promoted to deputy director of the FBI before he was inevitably forced to step down, right? Because there was a lot of uproar over the fact that this guy, is getting promoted after being responsible for, three of the most heinous events in American history. You know what I mean? But I thought that was at least worth mentioning, because Larry Potts was for sure a key player during these times,
This
but
guy, there he is.
that's him.
Happy, jolly looking guy.
Yeah. It's like
Exactly.
somebody's grandpa.
But so that one of the FBI agents at Waco claimed that this is what he said to a reporter, which I think is a perfect example of the prevailing mentality of these agents that conducted themselves in this way that, I mean, just tragic violence, man. You know what I mean? It's just like so crazy. But he said 5,000 to 1. Those are the odds against us. 5,000 people to every one officer of the law. Do you know how we keep order with those odds? Because people believe we're more powerful than we are. We project strength, and the people believe in that strength. When we sit outside a place like this for weeks on end, waiting for them to tire, we look weak in front of the rest of the world, and every asshole with a bomb kit starts getting ideas. This is more than a situation now. This is a symbol. Are we the kind of agency that coddles cop killers? I'm like, yeah, that's how they feel about us. You know what I mean?
Remember when David Chipman was up for the ATF. Remember that guy that they
Oh
wheeled out in
yeah.
front of Congress? He was there. He was there posing
Of
for pictures
course.
in front of the American flag, and there's like smoldering little
Oh
black
yeah.
babies behind him.
I got that picture
Jesus.
actually. I pulled that picture. Yeah. What a bastard, man. But, you know, I guess we should at least say I know you've probably covered this many times on your podcast, but PatCon is short for Patriot Conspiracy, right? And was a covert FBI operation that didn't just secretly infiltrate right-wing domestic extremist groups. The real objective in PatCon had been to seed infiltrators and to incite these fringe groups to violence. They even created fake militia groups, as we know, like the Veterans Aryan Movement, as well as running entrapment-based sting operations like Ruby Ridge with Randy Weaver. And they claim, like, the official narrative is that PatCon began in 91, but would only last until July 15th, 93, 6 months after the disastrous siege of the Branch Davidian compound. And it was directly overseen, like I said, by Larry Potts, assistant FBI director, later responsible for supervising that same operation from FBI headquarters. And that's what led to the accusations that Potts was the one to approve the order saying FBI agents should, can and should. But that's what effectively, made them change the rules of the standard rules of engagement. And the way that, by the way, they used that Geraldo Rivera flyover as the pretext for changing the ROE, because apparently right after that happened, that was they had this three-part long-term plan. It was an operation called Northern Exposure, and that they had come up in and with this at the FBI headquarters in Arlington. And basically, the second step was to conduct mass surveillance. And so that's when they rigged the entire tree line with cameras and all this. And then they went away for like 3 months. And it was like, from what I remember, it was during that time that Geraldo Rivera flew over, and that when they claim, apparently this is even in I believe it was an ATF document, if I recall. Could have been an FBI document, but it was one of the people who, one of the agents who were actually there that day rigging the surveillance in the tree line.
So
And
they
he
were like
claims he.
using Geraldo as a decoy or something like that.
Well, I think that that's what they used as the media pretext to, one, claim, look how radically violent the Weavers are. They're shooting at media helicopters, unprovoked, right? So clearly we can't talk with these people.
Did they
So it's
shoot at
almost
Geraldo?
no. And that was proven to not have happened. And even the helicopter pilot, who was an FBI agent, or at least the FBI helicopter pilot, who was flying around the media asset in Geraldo, he later claimed that never happened and that Randy never shot, no shots were fired. But after that helicopter flyover, and even, by the way, I was going to mention that in that report, that FBI agent claims, even he claims that that didn't happen. And he was there that day when the helicopter flew over, and that he said he never heard a shot fired.
Now,
And
who would send Geraldo in there?
yeah, so for me, I feel like there are key elements in the media institutions that are basically seeded into these mainstream media organizations
Operation
in order, and
Mockingbird, Deborah.
exactly. And they're infiltrating the media just the same as they are these right-wing extremist groups, allegedly, right?
And if you'll
And if not
remember,
more so.
Geraldo was at that time, all the daytime talk shows were big into the whole skinhead thing.
Oh yeah.
Geraldo had the skinheads from Portland break it. His nose got broken when the big fight broke out on his show, and everybody had him on at that time. I don't know if you remember, Deborah, but it was a
No,
big
I
deal.
yeah.
They'd have like skinheads on one day, they'd have Gigi Allen on, they'd have punk rockers, stuff like that. It's actually
Yep.
way more entertaining than daytime TV now, probably, but
But so he apparently the FBI, though, they received that those reports of that media helicopter being fired upon by Geraldo himself, Geraldo. Yeah. And so that
Geraldo said that it happened.
alone. Yep. That alone, I was very skeptical of that entire story, especially when they used the later on, they claimed that while they're there, and this is during the alleged negotiation when no one's allowed to even speak to them. So what are you ex exactly negotiating? But you know, apparently they did have like a robot that like that they're controlling with a remote, and that it had a shotgun mounted
Johnny
on the
Five.
front of it. Yeah. But it had a shotgun mounted on the front of it. I mean, you can't
Yeah.
even send the robot up without a gun. I mean, come on, man. You
Yeah.
know? But that was just ridiculous to me. But and then but along with that, like there's all these neighbors that are coming, except for the neighbor Terry Kinnison, who was the guy who wrote all those threatening letters to like claiming that Randy had told him he was going to assassinate the Pope and Reagan and yeah. And it was all because he was pissed because he had to pay out Randy in this court dispute over like a $3,000 land deal. It was like not even, but he hated Randy because he clearly and they like filed an affidavit before all this happened to claim that they believed that there was basically a conspiracy against them. I actually have it in my notes here that I need to, I'll find it here in a moment. But the main thing though, I did want to also say that what Jesse Trinity said before I'll get back to what I just mentioned though, but what he said PatCon was from his research, and he told Scott in 2011 on Dissent Radio, he basically, this is exactly what he said. He said, "As I pursued this over the last 16 years and lots of lawsuits and fights with the FBI, I stumbled across an operation that the FBI called PatCon, PatCon. PatCon was an acronym for Patriot Conspiracy, and the FBI began to distance itself from PatCon when I was probing. And they said it was just a simple operation where they were going to infiltrate some militia folks in Alabama who had stolen some night vision goggles from a military base and were selling them. But it was clear to me that PatCon was bigger than that, much, much bigger. And there were PatCon operations going on all over the country. They referred to them as PatCon Group 1, PatCon Group 2, PatCon Group 3. Apparently, it went on throughout the 90s because here last summer, I received a phone call from a fellow who said that I've been seeing what's been being posted on the internet from your FOIA lawsuits with the FBI. He said, "You have all the pieces, but you just haven't put them together." And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, you just don't see the picture." And so he came to see me, and I directed him to Newsweek magazine and to some other reporters.
Is
He
this
had
the
been
guy
one of the,
who's terminally ill?
well, I don't know if he is. It is the John Matthews is, I'm pretty sure, is who this is.
I think this guy was an informant and he was had terminal
Yep.
cancer.
Exactly. Now I didn't know that he had terminal cancer actually, but that makes sense why he'd be willing to talk to Jesse, you know,
Yeah.
honestly. But
But then he
so
gets shut down, right?
yeah, I'm pretty sure that, well, I know he did because that's when Eric Holder came in and he paid a visit. And basically he because he launched this entire mission and even like told his staff in these different emails like that came out during Jesse's FOIA requests and lawsuits that Eric Holder, who was a part of Janet Reno's Justice Department during the cover up of the Oklahoma City bombing, right? He was like assistant deputy attorney general. That's what he was. And so then he resurfaces under Obama's administration as attorney general. And it's at the same exact time that Jesse Trinidad's attempting to get Congress to investigate his brother's death, right? And so Eric Holder's role was not to allow that to happen, basically, to come in and make sure that Congress would not investigate Kenneth Trinidad's death. And so he launched a mission. He literally called it this to his staff. It was called the Trentadue mission. And he called Jesse more dangerous than Osama bin Laden. and even referred to him as Jesse bin Laden in his emails to his staff. And I just thought that, like, how dare you as a government official, you know, like, and then this comes out and nobody's held accountable. I mean, he's still viewed as this, you know, beacon of justice and in government. You know, it's just a ridiculous idea, but
yeah, the one thing that's so disheartening about that you read about in Aberration of the Heartland of the Real is so many times, based a lot of it because of Jesse Trenadue, like,
yeah,
federal and circuit judges and all this stuff will like go to the FBI and be like, hey, you need to give so and so this, you need to go find it, you need to go look again,
right?
You need to do this, you need to investigate this, and the FBI will just say no, or mm-hmm, we looked, we couldn't find it.
Exactly.
And then the they'll judge will be like, you need to go look again, and they'll be like, oh, we looked again, couldn't find it,
looks like it's we lost it.
That's our justice system, you know.
Exactly, man. But yet, like you were saying, though, this was one of the top undercover operatives for the FBI and PatCon for almost 10 years, he claimed, right? And he had infiltrated some 23 groups. And he started out believing, this is what he told Jesse, he started out believing it was the right thing. He wasn't, you know, so many of these informants are people who are caught in the act of committing a crime and are forced to go undercover for the FBI, you know, and mm-hmm, and he did it apparently voluntarily because he thought these hate groups, what they described to him as hate groups, were dangerous. In hindsight, he said, looking back on it, he sees now that the agenda was to infiltrate and incite the militia movement, the right-wing Christian movement, to violence, so that the Justice Department could crush them. He said that Ruby Ridge was a PatCon operation. He said that Waco was a PatCon operation. He believed that Oklahoma City was, but he wasn't involved in it. But he did say that other members of the PatCon group were involved in Oklahoma City.
Yeah. What do you think, speculation, what do you think the reasoning for wanting to crush white right-wing type militia groups would be?
I think that it was a very convenient narrative for the government, because I think that that's the exact ideology. It's targeting the very people in society who would pose the greatest threat to the expansion of the state.
Right.
In my mind, you know what I mean? Because at least in my mind, now I know a lot of my family included, I know a lot of good Christians that they seem to really trust the state, you know, mm-hmm, and it blows me away. But I feel like a lot of that was manufactured over time, you know, that it was things like this where they bought the official narrative.
Yeah.
And so to me, they were demonizing not just Randy, but his ideology, mm-hmm, what he could represent. And they wanted it to be a broad brush, right? They didn't want people to sit and debate about, was he a separatist or a supremacist? Or they didn't want to deal in nuance. No, absolutely not. They know that the average person seems to not be even capable of that, right?
Yeah.
So too many people will just accept that narrative on its face.
Yeah.
No matter how ridiculous it seems, right?
I think it can be used to justify whole departments of government that aren't necessary to give people who are leading cushy lives to keep jobs. And I also think that it's used just to usher in more control and things,
you know,
like
what I heard,
the Patriot Act and things like that. That can
exactly
come.
And look what happened right after OKC. Right. They passed that legislation, which was the precursor to the Patriot Act. I mean, it's exactly what they did.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I just think that it's pretty clear to me that clearly, I mean, honestly, all they ever do is escalate for potential press opportunities in moments where they are vying for funding, just like that, you know, that guy from Waco said. Right. And so to me, and I even read that which I don't believe this, you know, I don't know how much I believe it as far as like it actually being a legitimate consideration at the time to basically abolish the ATF. And this was apparently at least being considered in certain government circles at the time. This is what I've read. Now, again, like that seems too good to be true in my opinion. But at the same time, like clearly you had top officials at the ATF that were freaking out, you know, like they needed to prove their worth in their minds. And also they needed to, one, prove how valuable they were as a federal agency. And two, they needed to, you know, to basically get further funding, you know, and have it approved. And so I think that it was too, the timing is too perfect for that, you know, and when you have individuals who are admitting that to, you know, that much, then it's hard for me to steer away from that, at least being, you know, a theory that I really think has some credibility, you know?
Yeah.
But I can't say for sure, you know, but I will say that's what I believe, you know, that it seemed to be that in my mind, right? Like it was it's never only achieving, you know, there's never one.
It's never
priority.
One goal. Yeah.
Exactly. It's always a layered approach to these, you know, operations.
Layered and compartmentalized.
Most definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
And leading us to believe that they're protecting us, and so we need them.
Yeah.
Exactly. I know. Oh, look at what government did. We need more.
Shoot.
We need more government.
Good thing they were there.
Yeah. When on our last episode with Ken Silva, I asked him if, you know, federal informants were playing a role in like the left, the opposite side.
Yeah.
And he directed me to this podcast, like 10-part podcast called Alphabet Boys. Have you listened to that?
Oh, no, I haven't. I've heard Ken say something about that, though.
It's worth a listen. It's frustrating because the guy is just a horrible social justice warrior. But it talks about infiltrating, not Minneapolis, Antifa or BLM. Denver. Like Denver, BLM, and Antifa. And it's so cringy. You got to listen to it. The guy that they roll out as like the dude that Antifa thought was like a real deal operator was like this fat white dude who was like 50 years old with like a goatee. He's one of the guys that has the goatee to hide the fact that he doesn't have a chin. And like he's like wearing like Punisher skull shirts and like has a Punisher skull necklace and like some cargo pants and drives like a modern Cadillac hearse.
Oh my
and,
God.
And he'd like told all these like Antifa guys that he was like a high level operator, that he'd gone and fought for not the Mujahideen, but whoever that guy from TruAnon claims that he went and fought for.
Wow. Like the Iranian militia, the Mujahideen Khalq or something, or
yeah,
what?
Not the Mujahideen. It would have been the Mujahideen would have been the equivalent of it in the 80s, but the one that's modern now, the one that people,
yeah.
And
I
like,
think that's it, but I can't remember.
He did go and fight for him, but he didn't fight for him. He just like, I guess those, which makes a lot of, are you familiar with that show TruAnon? It's a big show. It's like a left wing, like far left conspiracy show, but everybody thinks that the guy that runs it's a Fed. My wife actually knows him
really
from 12-step program stuff.
Wow. That's hilarious.
But he claims that he went over there. But I guess like all these militant guys that are in it say like Western leftists just show up for the photo op and then like go home and don't do anything. Like rich Whoa. Leftist kids like do that. But
he
said this guy says he was in that. He says he like went, he tells everybody that he was in the French Foreign Legion, all this stuff like that.
Wow.
He wasn't in any of it. They interview like his wife, his ex-wife, who's like a stripper and has an OnlyFans page. And like
wow.
I looked up her Instagram, and if I was, you know, a Coomer simp who bought girls OnlyFans page, I would not
right.
I would not pay her the $3, the price of a McDouble a month for her content, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely
But
not.
it's just like you should listen to that. It's good. But what I came out from that show is that feds are infiltrating these guys to do stuff that's just gonna, and they never get, like, they got this black dude to, like, say on camera that he wanted to, that he was planning with this other dude to go, like, the guy had a wire on and everything, and he's planning to go kill the district attorney in Denver. And the guy gets let off
What?
with like 2 months parole or something like that. And like is upset
Wow.
that he got, says that it's racist that because he wasn't trapped, but like he says, it's like, do you understand what would have happened if you were like on the other side and you were
You're
on
right.
tape with a federal informant saying that you're going to go kill the district attorney of a
Oh
major
my
American
God.
city? Like,
Especially now.
my takeaway from that whole show is that the left is, and I, I'm from, like, I was living in Portland in the summer of 2020. I like saw
Right.
what was happening. Like,
Right.
it wasn't equal treatment on both sides of the aisle,
Right. No.
but I think that the left is infiltrated in that manner just to provoke the right. That's all that I think it is.
It
And then
wouldn't surprise me.
I think stuff like that makes normal people on the right extremists and act
I just
accordingly.
assume at this point, because we know COINTELPRO happened, so I mean, in my mind, it's just they've modernized these operations. It's PatCon never ended. MKUltra just went underground. I mean, I forget the name of the paper that was sent to Joseph Holsinger, who was like the aide to Congressman Leo Ryan, who was murdered at
At
Jonestown, right?
Jonestown,
Yeah, and he that's one of my favorite stories of all time, by the way, if it wasn't so screwed up and super sad and tragic,
Do you
but
listen to
it's
Transmissions from Jonestown?
oh yeah, for sure,
Do
man.
you
I mean,
listen
oh,
to Did you listen to the Martyr Maid Jonestown series?
I
Oh,
actually didn't, and I
dude,
love Martyr Maid, man. I
dude,
didn't know he did a Jonestown
yeah,
episode.
like some of the episodes are 5 hours long, not the
I know, I
series,
love
like,
that guy, man.
and yeah, he takes it all the way back to like eight the I think like the slavery days is when he starts his
That's
Jonestown
amazing.
series to
I
talk,
love it.
just to like, because I mean, Jonestown was a black cult with
Yeah, I
a
mean, except for
Caucasian
the inner,
Caucasian
the inner
leader and the
circle.
inner circle, and
Exactly.
like it just does
The
like a
hell.
really good job of explaining why these poor underprivileged black people from the Fillmore like joined Jonestown and why it seemed like the little black old church lady like didn't know what was going on. She was just like, these people, she wasn't a socialist, she was a little old black church lady,
Yeah, exactly, man.
but yeah, that Martyr Maid one is, and that one, man, that you'll really start noticing some
I
stuff
will
in
love
there.
that.
It's like just like all these like leftist whites, if you get my drift, from
Right.
college at that in the 60s, that just fetishized these black men and like just
My
ruined them, man.
gosh.
It's
Yeah,
pretty bad.
I'm
And then
eager to
they
listen to
all
this.
these Black Panther dudes get shot, go to prison, and then all these Jewish leftists just go back to their parents' summer home,
Right. That is crazy.
after like having like a romp with some like scary black dude for a
Right.
summer, like that's.
Yeah. Feel alive for a while. What the hell is going on? That's funny that you mentioned Daryl Cooper though, because from Martyr Maid, because I like Dan Carlin. Honestly, back I used to listen to Daniele Bilelli a little bit as well, as far as the History on Fire,
Yeah, his
at for a
voice is a
time.
bit much.
It was definitely, but I remember he did a Caravaggio episode about this artist, right, from the Renaissance period, and
Renaissance, yeah.
yeah, I thought it was a pretty amazing, very well done. It was pretty cool. I don't know, I'll have to do some research on that myself at some time. But anyway, the big thing was is that Dan Carlin, and when I found Daryl Cooper, I found that it was like 10 years ago at this point. I found his probably 8, 9. I found his Fear and Loathing in the New Jerusalem, right?
Yeah,
that whole
that's
series.
The first ones that he did, yeah.
Yep. And when I found that, you know why I found that? Because he came on Dan Carlin's interview podcast back in
oh,
the
he
day.
Did.
Yeah. And so that's where I found him from. And then I went and I listened to that because I grew up as a Southern Baptist, right? Like, and that was my experience. My parents are still, that's their way of life, right? And I understand. And honestly, I'm not saying anything negative, to be honest, but except for the fact that clearly there has been a massive impact in regard to Christian Zionism overtaking, classic Christianity in reality. You know, I mean, not that, at least certain values, in my opinion, that have been completely, misdirected, and for a certain reason. And this entire notion of the war in Gaza right now, like, it's really put me in a hard position with members of my own family, which has been very difficult to deal with, because
so Zionism is in like your family church.
Yes. And it really just plagues my soul, like, honestly, because I'm trying to explain that it's a misinterpretation. This is not a divine prophecy, sanctioned by God to commit a genocide. What are we talking about? And I can't get it through that God doesn't come in the form of a government, of a state. Like, in my opinion, how can you view that? How can that be your perspective spiritually? Just, in general, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, but there's only so much I can do. And at this point, I've basically given up because, I love them so much, and I just don't want to, I mean, just me having this opinion makes people that I know love me, but, legitimately not want to even have a relationship with me. And the fact that it could be that extreme.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm heartbroken a little bit, to be honest, because it's something that I feel like maybe a lot of people are going through, maybe at this time. And I just, like I mentioned at the beginning and a couple times, like, I really do try and focus on people's overall and intentions, because I need to be able to understand that, you're not intentionally being evil,
like,
and there's a lot of
led. You've been led there.
Exactly. And so, anyway, not to dwell on that. It's
oh,
the
man,
first time I've really touched on it publicly, but
yeah, it's important, man. I'm a Orthodox Christian, and we are not a Zionist organization, but we're an organization in America. I'm, Russian Orthodox, and every with about 20% of my church is Slavic. The rest is,
wow,
American converts.
And you, the denomination is, what did you say?
Russian Orthodox.
Russian Orthodox. Interesting.
And because of there's so many Protestant converts, like when this whole debacle started, like, I was, mm-hmm. At coffee hour with my godparents, sitting in the basement of the church, and like sitting at a table with a bunch of old people. And, we're not supposed to be Zionists, but they were definitely supportive of one side and not the other. And they eventually came around the table to me, and I just said, sorry guys, I think I have a way different view of Israel than you guys do. I think I should probably keep my mouth shut. And that's where
exactly.
It is. So it took a lot for me to not go further than that. But it's
exactly.
Funny because at my church is full of a bunch of based young chads and then like old boomers, and mm-hmm. One side supports one and one side supports the other, so
right. As is typically the case.
I think Zionism, like this 80% support of Zionism, I think it goes away with boomers. It dies with them, I think.
I mean you're probably right, man. I honestly think you might be right on that. But I'll try and just like touch on some details, like, you know, just like the Cy Hirsch document, clearly showing that there was, you know, there was a priority with Netanyahu and the IDF and the Israeli government to basically, you know, divide the loyalties of the Palestinian as far as the Palestinian Authority were concerned during the elections, and that, you know, that they armed and funded Hamas, and they honestly, what they wanted was to be able to associate the Palestinians with a group willing to commit violence, you know, and it would allow them the pretext to tear up the Abraham Accords, which wasn't even a legitimate peace treaty in the first place, clearly, you know, and when the PA is selected by the Israeli government, I mean, of course you don't have proper representation. I mean, so the average Palestinian is desperate just to be represented. I mean, are you kidding? I mean, come on, man.
Yeah.
But you say any of that, and, you know, it's like, you know, I've literally had people just dismiss it by saying, you know, if it doesn't come directly from the Bible, then, you know, your source is the devil, basically. And it's like, how do you even contend with that? You know, I mean, basically just have to take a back seat at that point. Have your own opinion.
Yeah. Talk about the Razorbacks game or something.
Exactly, man. But since I did mention the affidavit that Randy and Vicky filed after they had been approached, an attempt to flip them, right, because of the disgruntled neighbor Terry Kinnison, who told the Secret Service that Weaver was a member of Aryan Nations, an anti-Semitic neo-Nazi white supremacist terrorist, and that he had a large weapons cache at his residence. And that's when, on February 12th, 1985, two FBI agents, two Secret Service agents, and the county sheriff and chief investigator interviewed Vicky and Randy. And that's when they accused him of being a member of Aryan Nations, due to the fact that during their month-long investigation, they had witnessed him associating with a man by the name of Frank Kumnick, who was known to associate with members of the Aryan Nations. I just thought that was ridiculous.
That's the informant.
Exactly. And on February 28th, 1985, Randy and Vicky filed an affidavit with the county courthouse alleging that their personal enemies were plotting to provoke the FBI into attacking and killing the Weaver family. They put that on the record. I just couldn't believe this. And reportedly by May 6th, the Weavers sent President Reagan a letter claiming that their enemies may have sent him, Reagan, the threatening letter under a forged signature. And no evidence of such a letter ever surfaced. But in 1992, the prosecutor cited the 1985 letter as an overt act of the Weaver family conspiracy against the federal government, which is just absurd to me.
Yeah.
But
it's just, I mean,
how many times can, you know, I mean, to me, pattern recognition matters as well. You know, I mean, it's just so crazy that people have accepted these stories, right? Like with OKC, with Ruby Ridge, I mean, Waco, you know, it's just, how can you not need, like, don't you need to be exposed to the details before you become certain of anything? You know, like, I don't understand. And even then, you have to at least be careful and never be like, yes, you can have principles you're clearly, you know, confident in. But to set things to where you legitimately close your mind and you're not willing to even entertain or consider, you know, other ideas. And it's just, that's when there's no hope, you know.
Yeah.
Like,
so they I don't know, I think you're younger than me, but I was obsessed with Waco when it was happening. I was a 13-14 year old kid. Like, while the ashes were still smoldering, a made for TV Waco movie starring, I think, Randy Quaid
came out. You're right.
Wow.
And like it was made by the ATF, I I think.
Of
But it
course.
at like some point it shows like the there's like a little old lady with like a with like an AR-15. She like smashes, she uses the barrel
Oh.
and breaks the window out. She goes,
Oh my God.
"Die, die, copper!" And it's like is
Oh
shooting out
my
the
God.
window. Like, yeah.
It's so crazy.
Yeah.
Paired it with some Hollywood propaganda,
I
you
can't
know.
remember. I think David Koresh might have been Randy Quaid.
That's hilarious. I know
Cousin
that they did
Eddie.
a similar thing. Yeah, they did a similar thing with Ruby Ridge. And I know that like Laura Dern played Vicky and Kirsten Dunst played Sarah. And I think it was also very similar. It was like a Lifetime movie. It was like a
Yeah.
cartoon. And I
Yeah.
remember they act like they have a picture of Randy in a Klan outfit.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, it was so crazy. Like, well, in front of a burning cross, you
Of
know?
course.
I mean, it's just like, my God, man, you know?
So I have a question about, you mentioned that the skinheads wanted to give Randy, all these weapons. Did they make contact with him? And
I
did
think.
he accept them?
No, I don't know how they were planning to get it up the hill, but like I
Exactly.
think they got busted. There was a gate that was guarded by a bunch of federal agents. But as we know, like I think the point I was trying to make when it slipped my mind is that that place was 50% federal informants. So like, of course, they maybe came up with that and be like, okay, well, we can do this, this, and this if we bust the locals getting all wild.
That's so what I how I took that, especially since Randy came out and publicly, he vehemently like he like as far as I could tell, he was verbalizing the fact that he was never affiliated with those people that were out there that had swastikas and claimed to be supporting him. And to me, that helped, you know, confirm to the public this narrative that they were attempting to seed about, you know, Randy's clearly a Nazi, right? He's clearly someone who's radical, and you can't deal with this person. And I think that it just helped create the media pretext even more, you know, having those groups. And I mean, you know how they for example, I think a lot of Charlottesville, like with the tiki torches, like how many of those people were feds, at least like at least informants, you know? And so it's, to me, it just fits perfectly, right? Like, why would they not, you know, in, you know, create some small operation to bring some assets up to then have the media helicopters completely view that one road where they're the ones that are solely, you know, protesting on behalf of Randy. So I do think that helped allow the public to be on board as far as, yeah, do whatever's necessary. This guy's clearly violent, and you know,
And
but
how many of those, were
yeah, that's how I feel. Exactly. I mean, I definitely don't think the majority of them were, you know, actually genuinely believed what they were claiming. You know, I think it was kind of a setup, you know what I mean? But and you know, Frank Cumnick was the original target, the friend that he had gone to that Aryan Nations Congress meeting with. And so, but during his first and only appearance at such a meeting, like Randy was at least that this is what I've read about him going to this Aryan Congress, right? I did read that he went to local meetings, like that he had gone to certain local meetings as well, but this was the only time he had gone to like this compound, which is where this World Aryan Congress was having a meeting, which it sounds terrible, clearly. But as far as like,
Maybe they're saying that because that was like a once a year deal or
that
something
could
like
be,
that.
yeah. And that's what it seemed like it was anyway. Yeah.
But I
But
think he like went regularly to some of the just get-togethers, barbecues and
that's
stuff
what I
like that.
heard. Yeah, exactly. But he was introduced at that meeting to Gus Magasona, right? Which was an alias for Kenneth Fadley, the paid undercover BATF informant in the Aryan Nations. And he introduced himself to Frank Cumnick, because remember, he's the target of the initial investigation. And I think who they wanted to flip as an informant originally. And so it turns out he introduced himself to Frank Cumnick as a weapons dealer, right? And Cumnick, who was the original target, like I said, he subsequently introduced this Gus Magasono, this agent, to Randy. And that led to an exchange of contact information. And Randy and Gus, the confidential informant, seemingly became friends, right? Over the course of like 3 years, they met several times between 1986 and 1989. And I guess Randy like started trusting this guy. And then in October of 1989, Magasono asked Randy if he could acquire a minigun for him. And Randy apparently laughed and said no. But the informant then asked him if he was willing to sell him two shotguns with the barrel sawed off, like we said, right? And that's where I read that he even showed him where to cut, right? After Randy had initially began that cut at the legal limit. And then, like I said, though, that, you know, again, later, people were claiming that that wasn't even the case and that it was cut later by the FBI themselves, you know? So that could very well be what happened. And he was reluctant, I guess, but the story goes that he was strapped for cash, right? And that this Gus Magasono, as any informant or undercover operative they would be pretty persistent, I would imagine, you know? And so it turns out he decides, okay, he has the two shotguns anyways, and he sells them to him for $300. And so in November, so just a month later, an FBI informant approached Randy and tipped him off that the friend he had sold the shotguns to was a BATF informant. Why would the FBI informant tip off Randy that the BATF informant is who he sold the guns to? You know, like, it was just weird to me. I didn't understand that part of the story, you know? But 8 months
maybe
later,
he had some sort of, unlike the other guy, had some sort of, you know, issue with his conscience or something.
Yeah, right. He was, man, potentially he was an ethical person.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That wouldn't surprise me. I mean, that those
people
maybe
exist. Somebody who's like, I got forced into this because I don't want to go to prison.
Yeah. Exactly.
Maybe,
like
I
we
can
said earlier,
not,
yeah.
Maybe I can do the bare minimum and let people know when bad stuff's about to happen.
He could have. You're totally right. He could have felt bad for Randy to a certain degree. I mean, that wouldn't surprise me at all.
Or maybe it's somebody that was like the guy who contacted Jesse Trinity. It was like, I did this because I thought there
was
true. Real stuff going on. And this is a, you know, maybe not an average family man, but just a guy who's just trying to do right by his family and,
exactly,
and be on his own, you know?
Exactly. But 8 months after that, a couple of BATF agents approached Weaver and asked him, this is when they asked him to serve as an informant within the Aryan Nations. And they told him they didn't have a warrant, but they did have incriminating conversations on tape with him and Gus. They threatened him with arrest and confiscation of his truck or house if he didn't cooperate. And that's when Randy replied, fuck off. And in December 1990, Randy Weaver was indicted for manufacturing, possessing, and selling illegal firearms. The difference between legal and illegal in this case was about a quarter inch of a barrel per gun and a $200 tax stamp, right?
Yeah.
And on January 17th, 1991, two BATF agents posing as a couple having engine trouble with a pickup truck hauling
a
camper.
Yeah, this is this one, man. He
stopped
pulls
on
over,
the one
he
lane
pulls
bridge.
Over to help him. And that's how they
yeah,
arrest
oh,
him.
Oh, he's a terrible person. We can't deal with him. He's such a hate monger. And they pull over to help these people. Like, that just pissed me off. I'm not even, when I read this, I was so upset.
Yeah.
And they're posing like they have engine trouble. And they had stopped on the one lane bridge leading to the Weaver property. And Randy and Vicky stopped to help. When Randy looked under the hood, the male agent stuck a 45 caliber pistol to the back of his head and announced he was under arrest. Other law enforcement agents piled out of the camper, and Vicky Weaver was thrown face down into the snow and mud. Randy was taken into custody and later released on a $10,000 bond. Ooh, if you did that to my wife, I'd be so upset.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. But the trial was, this is when they set the stage, honestly, for the escalation. I think it was this whole facade about the no-show, you know, the failure to appear. And so it was originally set for February 19th, like I said earlier, and then they changed it to February 20th for the convenience of the BATF. But probation officer Carl Richin sent Weaver a letter dated February 7th, instructing him to appear on March 20th, right? So, although Assistant U.S. Yeah, exactly. Although Assistant U.S. Attorney Ron Howen, who later acted as prosecutor, knew Weaver had been sent an erroneous notification, he appeared before the grand jury on March 14th, 6 days before the date Richens gave Weaver, and got the indictment for failure to appear on February 20th. And on the 26th of February, a reporter telephoned the U.S. probation office and asked whether the reason that Weaver did not show in court on February 20th was that the letter sent to him by Richens had the incorrect date. Upon finding a copy of the letter, the chief probation officer, Terrence Hummel, contacted Judge Ryan's clerk and informed them of the incorrect date in the letter. And Hummel also contacted the U.S. Marshals Service and Weaver's attorney, informing them of the error. The judge, however, refused to withdraw the bench warrant, setting the stage, right? And in beginning in February 91, the United States Marshals Service developed this threat source profile on Weaver. And agents' failure to integrate new information into that profile was criticized in a 1995 report by a subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And this is what they said on this. They said, quote, "The subcommittee is concerned that as marshals investigating the Weaver case learned facts that contradicted information that previously had been provided, they did not adequately integrate their updated knowledge into their overall assessment of who Randy Weaver was or what threat he might pose. If the marshals made any attempt to assess the credibility of the various people who gave them information about Weaver, they never recorded their assessments. Thus, rather than maintaining the threat source profile as a living document, the marshals added new reports to an ever-expanding file, and their overall assessment never really changed. These problems rendered it difficult for other law enforcement officials to assess the Weaver case accurately without the benefit of firsthand briefings from persons who had continuing involvement with him." And this is when, in a memorandum by Deputy Attorney General Jamie Gorelick, dated April 5th in 95, it was cited in the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Terrorism Ruby Ridge report from 96, and opined that the assumptions of federal and some state and local law enforcement personnel about Weaver, that he was a Green Beret. This is what the internal character source profile that was circulating at the time internally.
He's like Rambo. Rambo is up there in Washington in the Pacific Northwest, going after Brian Dennehy, you know?
Uh-huh. And so they said he was a Green Beret. He would shoot anyone on site who attempted to arrest him. That he had collected.
Maybe you guys should address what you're doing with the special forces in the military in America then, you know? Like,
no kidding, right?
Yeah, if that's the kind of reaction that people are trained to be Green Berets have after their discharge from the military.
No kidding. That he had collected certain types of arms, that he had booby-trapped and tunneled his property. Right? Exaggerating.
They all had mini 14s, man. Mini 14s are rad, but they're not the arsenal that the normal person can get today.
Exactly,
it's like it's a coyote rifle.
Exactly. And I mean, even Sammy, that's what he used all the time on the property, you know. Yeah. It's crazy to me that they would use this as the source profile or threat source profile, because imagine all the agents that responded to this scene. I mean, if they truly believed this, like at least some of them had to, I would imagine, right? Like at least some of them weren't completely read in on the, maybe, I don't know, You know, I'm not certain, but it just seems to me like, I mean, clearly, I think Lon Horiuchi, the sniper,
He just
that
wants to
had
kill that guy.
confirmed
That guy's like
Waco.
a some sort of psychopath, Phoenix Project guy or something, you know?
It had to have been, man. I mean, had to have been, you know, but that so
Because he
they're
shows back up at
exaggerating.
Waco, right?
Yeah, he had confirmed kills there. And I mean, it's
God.
just so crazy, man. Yeah. And had to go into hiding afterward and
Wonder what
ended
he's up
up,
to
of
these
course.
days.
Yep. Oh, yeah. But so that's the threat source profile that all these people, it's clearly exaggerated. You know, I mean, it's just right. And I think that based on this threat source profile, they believe that they should change the rules of engagement effectively. And but they didn't do that until after the flyover of Geraldo Rivera, which I thought was ridiculous, man. But and you can stop me anytime you want, by the way. It's I don't know how long you guys want to go, but it's just
Well,
whatever
we've
you
been
want
going
to do.
2 hours. I think we could hang it up here.
If you want to, that's perfectly fine. I mean, I have way too much to go anyway. But honestly, I would like to read this very last statement, if you don't mind. And
Yeah,
then
go for it.
beyond that, I would love to do this again. This was a lot of fun, honestly. I really appreciate you guys having me on.
For sure.
But so this was, let me see. Let's see. Oh, yeah. Well, this is crazy. It's at least a brief, you know, Bo Gritz that I, if, did I mention him yet?
Not
Bo
yet.
Gritz. Okay. Well, yeah, he's James Gordon Gritz was a former United States Army Special Forces officer and worked in the office of the Secretary of Defense, right? He was a Green Beret commander as well. And following his formal retirement at the rank of lieutenant colonel in 79, he also trained the Afghan Mujahideen on military bases in America on behalf of the government, which is like, I always pictured it like, you know, some black site in Afghanistan, some
No,
secret
they just
base.
brought him over here.
They just brought him to America, man. I mean, like, that was just so ridiculous.
Tim Osmond and Bo Greitz just training together.
That's so crazy to me, man. And so he's the one former Green Beret commander who eventually negotiated Randy Weaver's surrender
Yeah, and he was
and
like
said,
kind of a he was a big conservative patriot AM
oh, yeah.
radio guy, like in the
Didn't he even
same
run for
ilk as,
president?
yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I'm pretty
In the
sure in
same,
92.
not like seriously, but just one of those guys who was always doing stunts like that. Yeah, so it was
Exactly.
like people that would listen to him would also listen to like Bill Cooper and stuff like that too.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Behold a pale horse.
Hour of the
That's
Time was Bill Cooper's show.
oh, was that?
Yeah, it's worth listening. You can go get every episode on the internet if you want to. So,
Oh, awesome.
yeah.
So, let's see. So, yeah, anyway, so Bo Gritz, right? So, like I said, he was the guy who inevitably eventually negotiated Randy Weaver's surrender.
And
He said
that's
that.
who Rambo's supposedly based
I
on
did
too.
know that. Yeah, I
Yeah.
did hear that actually. That's so funny to me. Well, his theory on Jonestown is pretty, it's not far off, I think, you know. I don't know how much we can trust Bo,
Yeah.
but at the same time, like, I do like some of the things he says, I'll be honest, right? And but so he inevitably said that after he became a negotiator, the FBI showed him a psychological profile of the family prepared for the Marshal Service before the siege that described Vicky as the dominant member of the family. He says, quote, "Vicky was the maternal head of the family," Gritz told the Spokane Spokesman Review. "I believe Vicky was shot purposely by the sniper as a priority target." The profile said, "If you get a chance, take Vicky Weaver out." And I just thought that was
Well,
interesting.
yeah.
But so this same guy though, a few he said, let's see, it was like in an interview, I believe he said this. Yeah, in an interview in regard to his books called Called to Serve and A Nation Betrayed in 1995. He said, "A few weeks ago, there was a report out of Montreal about people winning cases against the CIA because they were utterly abused in the mental health clinic that was set up by the CIA in Canada. That all came down under Alan Dulles, who tried to make a Manchurian candidate. I think the Jonestown incident was an extension of in search of the Manchurian candidate. I think those people were conditioned to act in certain ways and would have probably just moved from Montreal to Guyana in this case. You look at Jim Jones' background carefully. He had a lot of intelligence contacts there for doing exactly what he did. And by the way, I found out that Dr. Larry Layton, who was, he was running like the medical weapons program or something. Like he was very, very high up. I can't remember his actual official capacity of what his role was, but his whole family was involved in the leadership at Jonestown, including like he had his son, Larry Layton, there, who was on the death squad that went and killed Congressman Leo Ryan at the airstrip there,
yeah,
you know, Port Cayuma. And so I just thought it was totally crazy because in my most recent episode, I mention this insane Jonestown connection to the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, and it provided way more detail, but helped reinforce everything that I had said in my original Jonestown episode, because it clearly to me, and this is what Congressman Leo Ryan's aide said, you know, in a massive like media conference, basically he was saying it to it was directly in response to all of this, and he had gotten a letter from a Berkeley professor called the Penal Colony, and it explained how MK Ultra, it after the Church Committee hearings, when it was exposed to the public in the early 70s, it was forced to go underground after 73, and that all they did was create religious cults in order to, yes, in order to continue their research into MK Ultra. They just used these religious cults like Jonestown, like Luke Jure's Order of the Solar yeah. Temple or whatever it was called.
What's that one place in Chile? God damn it.
I'm sure I'll remember when you say it though.
Okay, keep going. Sorry.
No, you're good. I just think that entire
Colonial Dignidad.
I don't know about that.
Oh, one. Gotta look into that.
I gotta look into that. Yeah, for yeah. sure. You might. It hey, if you don't into, mind,
it gets
email
into
that
all
to me
this,
or something.
Pinochet stuff. They had like
really.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Awesome. Well,
colonial,
I need to go to the rabbit hole.
Colonia Dignidad is a German, like enclave in Chile. Like a religious, like a Christian religious cult, but they were doing like death squad hits there for the Chilean government.
Whoa.
Like the guy that ran it was a massive pedophile. You
oh,
could do
wow.
a, you should,
okay.
you should do an
You've
episode
sold
on
me.
It. Yeah, yeah.
That's absolutely crazy.
There's a like a 3-part docuseries on Amazon. It's not very good, but it's
awesome.
Worth watching.
Yeah, and no, I'll check it out. If you don't mind, DM me or email me the actual name so I can like
okay.
remember it, because I'm totally gonna forget.
But
yeah. I don't believe it. You hold too many facts in your head. I don't believe
it. Thank you. I swear I'm purging constantly. So like I'll forget just normal words.
Yeah, it's
you
like
should
one
be able
one
to
comes in and one goes out.
100%. It drives me nuts. But so this is what the interviewer in this scenario with Bo, before I finish this off for us, he asked Bo, did it go haywire about Jonestown? And Colonel Gritz, he responds and says, of course it went haywire. God be praised. Just like the Montreal Health Institute, it self-destructs because it's not good in its essence. Most of these folks involved were street people, so they didn't even have people who knew where they were or were concerned about their well-being. It escalated once they killed Congressman Leo Ryan. Basically, they had no other way to go, so they just tried to self-destruct the whole mission, and that means the death of hundreds of people. As I point out in the book, the medical examiner there made some startling statements, and we wouldn't even allow the bodies to be properly examined when they were brought back to the East Coast and turned in. So obviously it was a cover-up. Jonestown, I think, was an extension of MK Ultra from the CIA and there are probably other experiments going on. Alan Dulles is dead, but that doesn't mean that the idea of controlling people's minds and behavior is dead, and I still think that is a goal. So I just thought that's perfect, you know, like what, and then by the way, so the commander of the FBI hostage rescue team told Gritz he would resolve the standoff by launching an
Danny
all out.
Coulson?
No, Danny Coulson was actually pretty cool. You know, at least from what I read, like he's been like dropping bombs on during Waco, or I mean during OKC too. Isn't he the
Have
one
you...
that said about the 25 different witnesses saw John Doe 2 with McVeigh in the Ryder truck? And like,
yeah,
am I
have
for...
you, he's on, I don't know if you ever heard of that podcast, the Team House. There's a,
no.
It's like these two kind of spooked up special forces guys. It's a good show. They have like a lot. I mean, I'm super into the Rhodesian Bush War, so they have all these like Rhodesian dudes on there talking about it. They talked
Team House.
Yeah, Team House. So there's a two-part episode with Danny Coulson, and on the very end of the second part, he addresses that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Well, that's interesting because the all-out tactical assaults, if he couldn't get the remaining Weavers to surrender by a certain deadline, seems like their nature, as far as I'm concerned, right? I mean, like, that's what they did in Waco, you know, I mean, and especially after, you know, was it William Francis Bill Deegan who was killed, I think, was the U.S. Marshal in this circumstance that was the one that died. And when that happened, they didn't care that they shot Stryker, the dog, in the back after Stryker ran out, you know, and playfully ran around one of the agents and then playfully ran around the other and then ran back to Sammy. And as he's running back to Sammy, they shoot the dog through the back.
Yeah.
Right.
You're
and
making
that's
my
when
little
Sammy,
chihuahua mad.
Dude. Yeah. Good. Well, I mean, as far as he should be mad. No. But honestly, that's when I was like, man, I'm a 14-year-old kid. If I have a gun in my hands and I watch you shoot my dog on my property,
yeah,
hell
I don't care
yeah,
who you are.
Really?
Yeah, exactly.
There
But,
he is. There's the chihuahua.
that's hilarious.
Okay,
but,
Austin, tell everybody
yeah.
How to support you, where they could find you, do all that
awesome
stuff.
Sounds good, brother. All right, so I have my podcast called The Underclass Podcast. It's basically only on mostly all audio platforms right now. I don't really have a video podcast yet, but that's the goal, is to at least expand into more, you know, video platforms as well. But I do really enjoy these interviews, though. I feel like it's a nice, you know, it's a nice break, but also it's like it's a different thing. You have to approach it differently, you know, and I enjoy that. But I also, more than anything, I just love having open-minded conversations with like-minded individuals that I feel like I don't have to, you know, be overly careful. And as far as like, you know, I try and remain as objective as I can, and I try and approach things with legitimate proof and evidence when I claim to be certain of something, but just the ability to have a conversation that feels productive. And, you know, I mean, it's just a beautiful thing. And I can't thank you guys enough for having me on, honestly. And beyond that, like I said, the podcast, The Underclass Podcast, any audio platform. And then on Twitter, it's at Underclass Pod, and Instagram, it's at The Underclass Podcast. And that's basically it. But I would like to read this one tiny little quote by Tolstoy, because I think it would at least like help confirm the theme of this entire, what I think what we should take away from this, the ultimate conclusion to me is government is to blame, right? And so this Tolstoy quote I felt was just perfectly fitting. And he says, understand then, all of you, especially the young, that to want to impose an imaginary state of government on others by violence is not only a vulgar superstition, but even a criminal work. Understand that this work, far from assuring the well-being of humanity, is only a lie, a more or less unconscious hypocrisy, camouflaging the lowest passions we possess. I agree with that.
Yeah. What any hints on upcoming episodes you got in the works?
Man, I think honestly this next one's gonna be, I just said how I'm gonna try and like change things up so I don't remain in the darkness for too long, but I feel like it's the timing is right for the McMartin preschool episode. So
yeah.
Tunnels.
I mean, yeah, we got tunnels are hot right now.
That's what I mean. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Tunnels are so hot.
I know, man.
Austin, you're the man. Your show is awesome.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, we're going to take a little break from the show for a while, but anytime you want to come and chop it up with us, you find out some new stuff you got to get off your chest with somebody else, let me know. We'll crank
I would
one
love
up.
That.
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
One more thing before we go, and yeah. I hope this is okay because I feel like it's like, I just want to say this one last thing because I really think it's so important. And it's from Jess Walter's book, right? About Ruby Ridge called.
Yeah, that's the guy. Every Knee Shall Bend. Or Every Knee Shall Bow.
Well, this one was called. Did he write that as well? Because I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
You know, that. But this one, it was. This book's called Ruby Ridge, The Truth and Tragedy of the Randy Weaver Family.
Okay. One might be like the second edition.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. Okay, well, that, man, there's a reason that I've cited that other book title before, because I know that it had to have been Jess Walter as well. So, but I liked this because it pretty much summarized what the end result of everything years after the fact. And he says, in the 9 years since the standoff at Ruby Ridge, and in the 6 years since this book first appeared, much has happened, yet little has changed. Tens of millions of dollars have been spent on hearings and investigations that failed to resolve the most basic questions about the standoff. Almost $3.5 million was paid out in settlements that settled nothing. 9 years later, the courts are still flip-flopping over whether a federal agent should be tried for his actions at Ruby Ridge. Investigators, lawyers, and federal officers are still debating who shot first. Top FBI officials are still denying that they approved the Bureau's unprecedented and illegal orders to shoot civilians without provocation. 9 years later, the sniper who killed Vicky Weaver still works for the FBI. The case continues to hum on internet websites and scream from right-wing newspapers. The words Ruby Ridge are fixed at the bottom of every news story about the 10-year crisis of confidence and competence in the FBI. And every time a person holds up in a ramshackle house, every time a suspect refuses to come out, every time a person accuses the government of going too far, someone is likely to say, "We don't want this to become another Ruby Ridge." The Weaver case gave a name to that sometimes dangerous space between people and their government. It brought paranoia into the mainstream. For how can you convince people that their government isn't out to get them when on Ruby Ridge, the FBI gave itself permission to shoot its own citizens? How can you tell people to trust a government that covered up details of the case and assigned agents to investigate themselves? Damn.
Yeah, that's powerful stuff.
It is amazing. But thank you guys again, clearly.
Yeah,
I really
you.
Appreciate you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Austin. Let's stay in touch and keep up the good work, man. We appreciate it.
Absolutely, man. Thank you guys again. And we'll talk soon. I would love to do this again, like I said. So
great.
Have a good night, you guys.
See you guys. Thank
All right, you.
You
too.
Bye.
I'm not doing this for you. I'm doing this for me. I'm not signed on to killing all those old people. All those black babies, fuck you, motherfucking New World Order. I will get your ass. Delay that. It pisses me off. You sign on to playing God, you get burned. And all you dumbasses that serve the New World Order, idiots. Playing God all day. Deciding who lives and who dies.
Penis man.
And then I find out They're all screwing little kids and devil worshiping. Of course they are. Oh, you're the big elites. Oprah Winfrey and Ted Turner and Bill Clinton and Epstein, all in that seven-story pervert building in New York. What a bunch of freaks. And the fact that those pedophiles, and I'm calling Oprah Winfrey one, hope she burns in hell. Every damn one of you's a piece of crap. And you're going to be judged. So you just continue to enjoy hurting babies and hurting old people and hurting homeless people and turn us all into a bunch of idiots. Because you will be destroyed.
Mom, I'm transgender.